So do you take good care of your health? Do all right with your health, take good care of yourself? You eat right, you sleep right, you take a Miracle Max multivitamin every day, you do Rex Quando 3 times a week, you drink nothing but water and Tab. You know, you're doing good, you're taking care of yourself. I read about a guy who decided to turn over a new leaf. He said, man, I gotta do better. So he decided that he was going to go through the house and get rid of everything that was bad for him, all the food that was bad for him. And so after all that work, he was exhausted. He sat down on the sofa. He said, man, that was delicious. It's great. There's all kind of tips for being healthy. An article this week came out about mandarin oranges and the health of mandarin oranges. It was said in the article that one good thing about a mandarin orange is there is a rich amount of vitamin C, and that vitamin C can help your wounds heal quicker. So if you get hurt at Rex Quando, then just take some vitamin C and you'll heal up better. It also said that there was something called a flavonoid. Flavonoid, make sure I was saying that right, a flavonoid. Now, a flavonoid sounds like flavors that don't annoy you, but that's not what they are. That actually is something that's an antioxidant. An antioxidant helps against free radicals, and free radicals are bad for your body. So, aren't you glad I shared all of that healthy information with you? It's good stuff, right? It's good. We continue our series, Pleasant Places, today, where we're looking at a prayer that King David prayed 3,000 years ago. And he was praying this prayer because he was in trouble. He was having some trouble, and he had a lot of trouble in life. But it's this prayer, as we break it down, that we find what we are calling some pleasant places. Not physical places, but spiritual, emotional, mental places. Pleasant places to be. And in this particular moment of his prayer, he has an intriguing pleasant place. It's a place that can bring unique pain relief. It can bring healing. It can even bring a radical kind of freedom to your heart and mind and soul. So what kind of place is he praying about? Well, let's find out. Our message today is called Healthy Place. We're going to be looking at Psalm 16, verse 4. King David prays, "The pains of those who have acquired another god will be multiplied." Christianity proclaims to believe in the one true sovereign God, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, the God who so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, Jesus, to the world. And Jesus so loved the world that he became the perfect payment for the penalty of the curse of sin. The curse of sin that in one sense is over all of the world. And we know that, right? We see the curse of sin in the evil and the trouble and the chaos that we see in the world today. But in another sense, the curse of sin has lost, as the song says, has lost its grip on the life of a Christian. How is that possible? How is it possible that the curse of sin has been in some way lifted away, that it's lost the grip that it has on a believer? Well, it's because they have not acquired another God. By the grace of God, through the rescue and redemption of Jesus, a believer is not acquiring another God. David acknowledges the reality that's behind the pain and suffering that comes from acquiring other gods. He's saying that if God is not your first and most and only devotion, then there will be pain that will be multiplied to you as you try to acquire other little g gods. Now, if we think about this, it may sound like what David's saying is, hey, If you are true and faithful, that God is your first and most devotion, you have no other God but that God, then you will never experience pain and suffering. That's not true. That's not true. There is no human being, past, present, or future, that can escape pain and suffering. And we don't want to, because here's the thing. Pain and suffering actually helps us see that joy and comfort exist. Without the pain and suffering, we'd have no understanding of joy and comfort, and we wouldn't know how to enjoy joy and comfort, and we wouldn't long for joy and comfort. So the math all works together. Pursuing the one true sovereign God, loving Him first and most, being devoted to Him only, does not mean that your life will be easy. It does not mean that you will get all of the health and wealth and all the benefits in life that you long for. But it does mean this. It means that pain and suffering will not and cannot be the final chapter of your existence. It's impossible. Now, someone would say, well, I don't care about that. I don't care about the final chapter of my existence, meaning the chapter that lasts forever. I don't care about that. Hey, you know what? I just want to eat, drink, and be merry today. I'm just going to enjoy life today. Don't really care if there's an afterlife or heaven or hell. I'm just going to ignore that. I'm going to forget about it, or I'm going to deny it. There's only one problem with that. We have been hardwired to know that denying it is foolish. We've been hardwired to know that there is something more. King Solomon was writing about the relationship between God and humanity, and he said this in Ecclesiastes 3:11. He has also set eternity in their heart. Eternity has been set in the heart of every human being. Again, we can ignore that. We can deny it. We can act like it doesn't exist. But every human being, past, present, and future, knows they've been created with this innate understanding, this deep reality, that there is more than just this life. Someone said that God placed eternity in our hearts as a magnet drawing us to Himself. Love that. So what does that mean? What does that look like? Well, think of it this way. Let's just look at the world that we're living in. Look at what we have to see and hear and deal with, all the chaos, all the evil, all the trouble, all the things that we deal with day after day after day. So at the very least, for God to put eternity in our hearts means that there's something we're longing for. And it's not just that we're longing for more. We've been created to long for more. We want something more than the bad that we see. And so in our longing for more, we begin to look to work, you know, better job, better house, better car. In our longing for more, we begin to look toward a spouse or a family or kids. We begin to look toward hobbies and money. We begin to look toward hunting and fishing and golfing and shopping. We begin to look toward soap operas or wine or whiskey or religion or politics or just about anything else that's out there. And we look for those things as the more, but the math is so intriguing because as we pursue those things as the more we are longing for, we always end up longing for more. In other words, none of those people, none of those places, none of those things begin to satisfy us. Why? Because as long as our search for more excludes Jesus, then we'll always be looking for more. When the search of our lives is not focused on the Jesus of the Bible, not just the Jesus of the Bible stories we like, but the Jesus seen in the entirety of the Bible. The Jesus that said, "Repent from sin. You're a sinner. You do the wrong thing. There is enmity between you and God. Things are not right between you and God. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near." The same Jesus that said that he was the only way and the only truth and the only life when it comes to eternity. That Jesus. And that eternity has been set in the heart of every single human. Past, present, and future, that eternity has been set in the heart. And the key to uncovering and discovering and embracing and enjoying that eternity is all completely, perfectly found in Jesus Christ, the Son of the one true sovereign God. David's having a moment of trouble. Things aren't good. And in his moment of trouble, when things are not going the way he wanted them to go. By the way, have you ever had any moments like that? Anybody have any moments this week where something didn't go your way? Anybody wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and your eye hurt and you're like, hey, I got too much to do? Yeah. I mean, something's gone wrong this week, right? Something was trouble. Something was not how you thought it would be. And in that moment, what does David do? Well, here's what he doesn't do. He doesn't go looking for other gods. He doesn't look at this moment of trouble and say, man, I need to go find something better. God's not enough. What do we do in moments of trouble? Well, we go look for medicine. There's nothing wrong with that. We go look for eye drops. There's nothing wrong with that. But in moments of trouble, we go look for another job, and we go look for another car. We go look for another house. In moments of trouble, we go look for a new leather clutch or a new putter. In moments of trouble, we may go look for a new hobby or another boyfriend or another girlfriend. We may go look for another candidate or another religion. We may go look for another diet. We may go look for another spouse. We may go look for another glass of wine or whiskey. And don't miss the reality of that list. Every single part of what I just described, all of those in that list, they can all be gods. And if we look to any of those things as our rescue and our comfort, David says pain, a type of pain that's hard to comprehend, that type of pain will be multiplied. What kind of pain is that? What type of pain is he referring to? Well, in simplest terms, he's referring to a separation from God, or we could just say a barrier between us and God. That's what sin does. That's what idolatry does. When we begin to choose other gods over the God, we are creating a world of idols. And we always say, oh, we're Christians, we're Southern Baptists. You know, we don't have idols, we don't have statues in our house. Yes, we do. They may not be religious statues. They might be a statue of your favorite sports team. It might be a statue of your favorite hobby. It might be a closet full of shoes that you don't need. It might be a workshop full of tools you don't need. We have things that can be idols. They're not evil in and of themselves, but we make them idols when they become our number one, first, and only devotion, what we pour ourselves into the most. And David says that type of idolatry creates barriers between us and God. And what does that barrier mean? Here's what it means. To have a barrier between us and God, even temporarily, means that we're cutting ourselves off, in a sense, from everything that is holy and happy and satisfying. And that's what sin does. That's what idolatry does. And when it comes to the deepest realities of how our hearts and our minds and our souls work, there is only one definition that we've been created with. And that definition, when it comes to salvation and satisfaction, is we can only find satisfaction in God. Not in little g gods, but only in the one true sovereign God. And being right with that God. And the only way to be right with the one true God is through the rescue and redemption of Jesus Christ. So have you been rescued and redeemed by Jesus? Not just have you prayed a prayer and joined the church, but have you been captured by the good news of the gospel? Have you been rescued and redeemed by Jesus? There is no God that can produce and provide what God has produced and provided for you in Jesus. No other God. I've heard a couple of well-known professing atheists say in recent years that the only difference between a Christian and an atheist is that an atheist doesn't believe in just one more God. You may have heard this before, and it goes like this. Well, Christians only believe in the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and David. They only believe the one true God. They don't believe in other gods. And so the notion is an atheist just doesn't believe, an atheist would agree with that. Oh yeah, we don't believe in any of the gods that you believe in, that you say you don't believe in either. We just believe in one more. We don't believe in just one more. So just add one more to the list. But what David is saying in his moment of trouble, this powerful, mighty, intelligent king, through the truth of God's word that had been written down, through his own personal experiences, through a rational, reasonable mind, David is praying and saying in his prayer that to dismiss the one God is the most terrifying dismissal you can make. It makes all the difference in the world. Why? Because that one God sent Jesus to be the legitimate satisfaction for the penalty of sin. And that one God raised Jesus from the dead so that the death that Jesus died on the cross outside of Jerusalem would be a guaranteed legitimate payment for the penalty of sin. The only way for the grip of sin to lose its grip on you. Therefore, to deny the one God means that sin's grip is still firm. Tim Keller said this, if Jesus rose from the dead, then you have to accept all that he said. In other words, if he rose from the dead, the craziest thing that could possibly be a reality, if that's true, then there's no reason for him to have lied about anything else. Rising from the dead is the guarantee that what he said was true. But then he goes on. If he didn't rise from the dead, then why worry about any of what he said? If he didn't rise from the dead, he's just another crackpot religious figure. And then Keller says this, the issue on which everything hangs is not whether or not you like his teaching, but whether or not he rose from the dead. Look at all the issues that we're facing in the world today. Whether it's politics or religion or sexual identity, whether it's the state of the economy, whatever it is, whatever you are confused about or whatever you are confident about when it comes to any of the topics of life, just understand this, that whatever it is we're dealing with in this world, compared to ignoring and denying the resurrection of Christ, that all of those things, they will not amount to a hill of beans when you breathe your last breath. But when you breathe your last breath, what you have done with the question of the resurrection of Jesus matters a hill of being, because your being never ends. So what you believe about eternity is completely wrapped up in the person of Jesus Christ, and rejecting him means multiplying pain and suffering forever. So when David says, I will not acquire other gods, it's not a passing statement in a prayer. It is the hope of his existence. And it is the hope of his eternity. And dear friend, the same is true for us. It is the hope of our existence and the hope of our eternity to know and love and follow the one true God. David was having nothing to do with finding other gods when he was in trouble. Listen to what he says in the next part of verse 4. I will not pour out their drink offerings of blood. As I have said often, one of the reasons that I'm so thankful for the love and mercy and grace and power and authority and crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension of Jesus is because I do not have to any longer pour out animal blood between the first and second songs we sing on Sunday morning. That's a good thing. I like that. Jesus became the ultimate sacrifice, the perfect sacrifice, the legitimate guaranteed payment for sin. Jesus truly paid it all of it. But that is not what our culture says we need the most. It's not. And by culture, I mean the world of sin from the Garden of Eden with the first two people to right now and even beyond. Because there's never been a moment in history, no matter how much we go, oh, this is the worst time in history, there has never been a moment in history where there has not been at least one voice saying, do you really need God? Nah. Any of the gods will do. Any of them. What you really need to make your life better and brighter is this, or this, or this, or this. You need to spend your time here. You need to make sure your kids learn how to do this. You need to be responsible with this. You need to save this money. You need to go to this school, whatever it may be. We are convinced by so many voices that we need something more than God. David said, man, I'm not listening to those voices. But he could have, right? I mean, David was a king, but he's still just a man. He's still just a human being. And what do we as human beings do when things get hard, when trouble comes? We're tempted to do what? Hey, God, what are you doing here? Why isn't this worked out? God, why haven't you put these things together? Why is this happening, God? Or God, you know, what have you done? I know you did that a few weeks ago, but what are you doing for me now? Just shy of 2,000 years ago, Simon Peter was writing to some Christians who were experiencing a great deal of pain and suffering, and this is what he said to them, 1 Peter 4:3, for the time already past is sufficient for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles. In other words, hey man, it's time to move on. You guys do not need to be chasing after the desire of the Gentiles anymore. And what is the desire of the Gentiles? Well, he tells us, continuing in verse 3, having pursued a course of indecent behavior, lust, drunkenness, carousing, drinking parties, and wanton idolatries. Not a word we use all the time. But what Peter's doing is, he's saying, look, you guys need to move on. They were sitting at the fire of desire a little too long. He's saying, look, there's a desire that you have in your life, and it's not good, because it's a desire to consistently engage in food and alcohol and immorality in such a way that it's not just bad and it's not just controlling you, but sometimes it's even illegal, and at the very least, it's dishonoring God and dishonoring the people around you. And Peter says, yeah, stop doing that. And see, that's what sin does. Sin convinces us that we're in control. Sin convinces us that what's happening is fine, that it's no big deal. Sin convinces us that this is our healthy place. But what sin doesn't tell us is the truth, and that this promised healthy place is actually an unhealthy place that could even be a deadly place. That's what sin does. And so Peter is pleading with them, guys, you are spending your time, your energy, your emotions on things that are not true. It's not true. And when we finish with all the acts of sin and selfishness in our life, whatever they may be, laziness, drunkenness, gluttonness, you know, whatever you want to put in there, disobedience to parents, I mean, Paul's mentioned that one. Any of those things, what we discover is that sin lied. Right? I mean, we see it. Sin lied. Because when we're done, after we're dabbled with the lies, we're left bitter or frustrated. We're left guilty, unfulfilled, broken, because we've destroyed the relationships that mattered to us the most. David's in trouble, but he's not pouring out blood for gods that are liars. He ain't stopping there. Listen to the next part of verse 4. Nor will I take their names upon my lips. Someone once said, if Jesus is on your heart, he's going to come out of your mouth. You know, the idea is that if you are devoting yourself in some way to following after Jesus, it's going to be seen in what you say and what you do and how you think, etc. Now look, none of us are perfect, all right? We're not, you know, so we're not going to do this all the time. But generally speaking, when it comes to politics or religion or the economy or whatever the topic of the day may be, the people that you work with, the people that you live with, the people you go to school with, the people you go to church with, the doctors and the nurses and the caregivers looking after your life, or anyone else around your life, how often do they hear Jesus from our mouths? And I'm not talking about just saying the name of Jesus, but how often do they hear people who are confident in the one true God? Not one God amongst many gods, but the only God amongst many gods. How often do people hear us speak the ways and the truths and the attitudes that we find in Jesus? How do they see that in our lives? Or do they often hear the gods of anger and frustration? Or do they hear the gods of worry and fear? Or do they hear the gods of whining and complaining and grumbling? Look, we're all going to have our moments, but what are we most known for? Well, what are we most known for? If we're still of sound mind and sound ability, is there something happening inside of us that we are so devoted to Jesus that there's something about the truth connected him that comes out more than just regurgitating what we hear in the sound bites of the news? David knew there was only one true God, and he was not going to let the names of any other gods come out of his mouth. Why? Because he knew he couldn't trust them. There were a lot of gods around David at the time. He knew about some of them, but he knew they were liars. He knew they were statues made by men. He knew he couldn't be confident in them. He knew that even if there was some temporary happiness, for lack of a better word, that ultimately in those little g gods, there was going to be eternal pain and suffering, suffering that would be multiplied. But in the one true God, in the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, David said, I can be confident. I can be confident that this one true God is my everlasting healthy place, and that nothing can change that. I was reading an article this week about a woman named Dr. Sharon Hirsch. She once visited a village in Cambodia that was known for being associated with the Khmer Rouge. The Khmer Rouge was a communist regime that back in the late 70s was known for just a brutal spree of torture, murder, genocide. And in this one village, these people never wandered far from home. They didn't go out much. And the reason they didn't go out much is because being associated with that evil regime from decades prior made them blacklisted in their own country. They were, in essence, kind of being held accountable for the sins of the generations before them. So they didn't leave much. Dr. Hirsch attended a Christian church service one time in the village while she was there. And she said it was the most overwhelming experience she had ever had in a worship service. The article described it this way. There was so much joy, so much emotion, so much confession, so much exultation and desire for God. They were excited, expectant, enthusiastic, and enthralled. Just to be clear, they were also hated, despised, isolated, and rejected. Is that how we respond when we're despised and rejected? Do we exalt the more in God? They were excited, expectant, enthusiastic, and enthralled. So Dr. Hirst turned to one of the villagers and said, "Are the services always like this?" And the villager said, "Yeah, they are." And this was the explanation. They believe that God is the only one who wants them. And so they want him. Remembering that moment later, Dr. Hirst said this, "To be totally known and still to be wanted is the way to liberation." In other words, freedom is found in the one that knows you the most, and that can only be God, and yet still wants you. David had a moment of trouble. And in his moment of trouble, rather than do what we are all tempted to do, he did not go look for another God. He knew that was a path of endless pain, a prison of pain in some ways. Rather, he went to the one true sovereign God. David went to the God and kept going to the God and kept going to the God. No matter what happened at the hospital, no matter what happened at home, no matter what happened at work, no matter what happened in traffic, no matter what happened with the government, no matter what, David kept going to the God who put a magnet in his heart, drawing him to eternity. And why would David do that? Because David had discovered that that was the best and healthiest place.